A 5,000-pound weight is put on deck, 10 feet off the center line, and the resulting angle of heel is run through a standard formula that gives the righting moment. So many things can affect the stability of a boat, though, that even the Coast Guard considers these tests to be of limited value. Load a few tons of gear onto the deck. Take a little water in her bilge. Shift from long lining to dragging to gill netting, and the dynamics of the ship change completely. As a result, stability tests are mandatory only for vessels over 79 feet. At deck height, the Andrea Gale measures 72. When the Andrea Gale was overhauled in 1986, Bob Brown simply pulled her out of the water and started welding. No stability tests were performed. No marine architect was consulted. In the trade, this is known as eyeball engineering, and it includes the Andrea Gale in an overwhelming majority of the commercial fleet that has been altered without plans. The work was done at St. Augustine Trawlers in St. Augustine, Florida. In all, 8 tons of machinery and structural changes were added to the boat, including the fuel and water drums on her whaleback deck. After the work was finished, Marine surveyor James Simonich, whose brother Mark would propose shutting down George's Bank the following year, flew to Florida to reinspect the Andrea Gale. 2 years earlier, he'd appraised both the Hannah Bowden and Andrea Gale for the settlement of Bob Brown's divorce, and the Andrea Gale had been valued at $400,000. Simonich surveyed her again in January 1987 and wrote a letter to Bob Brown with some minor suggestions. Loosen the dogs on one of the watertight doors and provide flotation collars and lights for the survival suits. Otherwise, the vessel seemed shipshape. The modifications and additional furnishings will increase the vessel's ability to make longer trips and return with a high-quality product, Simonich concluded. The question of stability never came up. In 1990, St. Augustine Shipyards was sold by the Internal Revenue Service for non-payment of taxes. In October of that year, Simonich visited the Andrea Gale in Gloucester and made a few more suggestions. Professionally service the 6-man life raft. Replace a dead battery in the Class B EPIRB. And install a flare kit in the wheelhouse. Again, there was no mention of stability tests, but the vessel was well within the law. Bob Brown also neglected to refile documentation for the Andrea Gale after altering her hull, although neither discrepancy was Simonich's problem. He was paid to look at a boat and evaluate what he saw. In November 1990, the principal surveyor for Marine Safety Consultants Incorporated, the company that employed Simonich, inspected the Andrea Gale one last time. The vessel is well suited for its purpose, he wrote. Submitted without prejudice, David C. Dubois. If Billy Tyne were inclined to worry, though, there were a number of things about the Andrea Gale that might have given him pause. First of all, according to Tommy Berry of the Allison, she had a boxy construction and a forward wheelhouse that took the seas hard. She was a rugged boat that didn't concede much to the elements. And then there were the St. Augustine alterations. The extended whaleback deck was burdened with the weight of an ice maker and 3 dozen 55-gallon drums, so her center of gravity had been raised, and she would recover from rolls a little more slowly. Only a couple of other boats in the fleet, the Eagle Eye, the Seahawk, store fuel oil on their upper decks. The portside bulwark on the Andrea Gale could be a problem, too. It had been raised and extended to protect the fishing gear, but it also tended to hold water on deck. A few years earlier, she'd taken a big sea over the stern and was pushed so far over that her rudder came partway out of the water. Bob Brown was on board, and he sprinted up to the wheelhouse and put the helm around. At the same moment, the boat rode up the face of another big sea. Slowly, The Andrea Gale righted herself and cleared her decks. Everything was fine except that the bulwark had been flattened like a tin can. One could argue that if a wave takes a piece of a boat out, maybe it shouldn't be there. Or one could argue that that's just what waves do, tear down what men put up. Either way, the incident was unsettling. Brown blamed it on the inexperience of the man at the helm and said that it was his own quick action that saved the boat. The crew didn't see it that way. They saw a boat pinned on her port side by a mass of water and then righted by freak wave action. In other words, they saw bad luck briefly followed by good. The bulwark was replaced as soon as they got in, and nobody mentioned it again. Bob Brown's reputation in Gloucester is a complex one. On the one hand, he's a phenomenally successful businessman who started with nothing and still works as hard as any crew member on any of his boats. On the other hand, it's hard to find a fisherman in town who has anything good to say about him. Fishing's a marginal business, though, and people don't succeed in it by being well-liked. They succeed by being tough. Some, such as Gloucester fisherman Hard Bob Millard, are tough on themselves, and some are tough on their employees. Brown is tough on both. When he was a young man, people called him Crazy Brown because he took such horrific risks, tub trawling for cod and haddock in an open wooden boat all winter long. He had no radio, Loran, or pathometer, and worked alone because no one would go with him. He remembers winter days when he had to slide a skiff out across the harbor ice just to get to his mooring. "I had a family to feed, and I was intent upon doing that," he says. Only once in his life did he work for someone else, a six-month stint with a company that was exploring the lobster population on the continental shelf. That was in 1966. 3 years later, he was working 200 miles offshore in a 40-foot wooden boat. "Never so much as cracked a pane of glass," he says. "Bigger doesn't always mean better." Eventually, he was running 4 or 5 sword boats out of Gloucester and pulling in hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. One winter, he and his son started accumulating ice on deck on their way back from George's Bank. If you're making ice on George's, you know you're going to be in real trouble closer to land, he says. We went back out, and that night it blew 100 from the northwest and snowed. The wind gauge only goes to 100, and it was pegged for 3 days straight, pegged like it was broken. We were in a steel boat, and it didn't seem so bad. We were comfortable enough. Steel's tough compared to wood. Don't let anyone tell you different. Anyone tells you different, they're a romanticist. Steel goes down faster, though. It goes down, well, like a load of steel. The bad feeling between Bob Brown and the town of Gloucester hit bottom in 1980, when Brown lost a man off a boat named the Sea Fever. The Sea Fever was a 50-foot wooden boat with a crew of 3 that was hauling lobster traps off George's Bank. It was late November, and the Weather Service predicted several days of moderate winds, but they were catastrophically wrong. One of the worst storms on record had just drawn a deep breath off the Carolinas. It screamed northward all night and slammed into George's Bank around dawn, dredging up 70-foot waves in the weird shallows of the continental shelf. To make matters worse, a crucial offshore data buoy had been malfunctioning for the past 2.5 months, and the Weather Service had no idea what was going on out there. The men on the Sea Fever and on another boat, the 55-foot Fair Wind, woke up to find themselves in a fight for their lives. The Fair Wind got the worse end of the deal. She flipped end over end in an enormous wave, and her 4 crew were trapped in the flooded pilot house. One of them, a shaggy 33-year-old machinist named Ernie Hazard, managed to gulp some air and pull himself through a window. He burst to the surface and swam to a self-inflating life raft that had popped up, tethered, alongside the boat. The Fair Wind continued to founder, hull up, for another hour, but the rest of the crew never made it out, so Hazard finally cut the tether and set himself adrift. For 2 days he scudded through the storm, capsizing over and over, until a Navy P-3 jet spotted him and dropped an orange smoke marker. He was picked up by a Coast Guard cutter and then rushed by helicopter to a hospital on Cape Cod. He'd survived 2 days in his underwear on the North Atlantic. Later, when asked how long it took him to warm up after his ordeal, he said, without a hint of irony, "Oh, 3 or 4 months." The sea fever fared a little better, but not much. She took a huge sea and lost all her windows. The half-inch safety glass burst as if it had been hit by a wrecking ball. The captain, who happened to be Bob Brown's son, turned down sea to avoid any more flooding, but the wave put them on their beam ends and swept one of the crew out of the wheelhouse and over the side. The man's name was Gary Brown, no relation. While one of the remaining crew scrambled below deck to restart the engine, the other threw a lifesaver overboard to save Brown. It dropped right in front of him, but he made no attempt to grab it. Brown just drifted away, a dazed look in his eyes. The other two men called a mayday, and an hour later, a Coast Guard helicopter was pounding overhead in the wild dark. By then, the two men on board the Sea Fever had righted her and pumped her out. "Do you wish to remain with your vessel, or do you wish to be taken off by hoists?" the helicopter pilot asked over the radio. "We'll stay with the boat," they radioed back. The pilot lowered a bilge pump and then veered back toward shore because he was running out of fuel. On the way back, he turned on his night sun searchlight to look for Gary Brown, but all he could see were the foam-streaked waves. Brown had long since gone under. 4 years later, U.S. District Judge Joseph Toro in Boston ruled that the National Weather Service was negligent in their failure to repair the broken data buoy. "Had it been working," he wrote, "the Weather Service might have predicted the storm, and furthermore, they failed to warn fishermen that they were making forecasts with incomplete information." This was the first time the government had ever been held responsible for a bad forecast, and it sent shudders of dread through the federal government. Every plane crash, every car accident could now conceivably be linked to weather forecasting. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration appealed the decision, and it was quickly overturned by a higher court. None of this was Bob Brown's fault, of course. There's nothing irresponsible about going to George's in November. He'd done it his whole life and worse, and the storm was completely unforecast. Moreover, a larger steel-hulled boat sank while the Sea Fever remained afloat. That said a lot about her crew and general state of repair. Still, a man had died on one of Bob Brown's boats, and that was all a lot of people needed to know. A story went around about how Bob Brown once spotted the biggest wave of his life, an enormous Grand Banks Rogue, and didn't even stop fishing. He just kept hauling his gear. People started calling him Suicide Brown, because working for him meant risking your life. And then it happened again. It was the mid-80s, and boats were making $1 million a year. Brown was out on the Grand Banks on the Hanabodon, and he found himself having to haul back a full set of gear in a 60-knot breeze. At one point, a wave swept the deck, and when the boat climbed back out of the white water, two men had gone overboard. They were wearing rain gear and thigh-high rubber boots and could hardly move in the freezing Newfoundland water. One of them went under immediately, but the other man was smashed back against the hull, and a quick-thinking member of the crew extended a gaff hook over the side for him to grab. The hook went through the man's hand, but the situation was too desperate to worry about it, and they hauled him on board anyway. They had to steam 400 miles just to get him to within helicopter range to be taken to a hospital. Brown's reputation is no concern of Billy's, though. Brown's not on the boat. He's 1,200 miles away in Gloucester, and if Billy doesn't want him in his life, he just doesn't pick up the radio mic. Furthermore, Billy's making money hand over fist on his boat, and that makes Brown's scruples, or his judgment, or his lack of empathy, all but irrelevant. All Billy needs is 5 men, a well-maintained boat, and enough fuel to get to and from the Flemish Cap. The first 5 sets of Johnston's trip are on what's called the front side of the moon, the quarters leading up to full. Boats that fish the front side tend to get small males on the line. Boats that fish the back side get large females. Johnston's record is 27 consecutive hooks with a fish on each, mostly small males. On the day of the full moon, the catch abruptly switches over to huge females and stays that way for a couple of weeks. You might go from an average weight of 70 pounds, all males, to 4 or 5 800-pounders, all females, Johnston says. They lose their heads on the full moon. They feed with reckless abandon. The full moon is on October 23rd, and Johnston has timed his trip to straddle that date. There are captains who will cut a good trip short just to stay on the lunar cycle. The first 4 or 5 sets of Johnston's trip are spare, but then he starts to get into the fish. By the 21st, he's landing 6,000 or 7,000 pounds of big eye a day, enough to make his trip in a week. The weather has been exceptionally good for the season, and Johnston gets on the VHF every night to give the rest of the fleet a quick update. As the westernmost boat, the fleet relies on him to decide how much gear to fish. They don't want 40 miles of line hanging out there with a storm coming on. On October 22nd, the Lorry Dawn 8, a converted oil boat captained by a quiet Texan named Larry Davis, leaves New Bedford for the Grand Banks. She's the last boat of the season to head out to the fishing grounds. The same day, a container ship named the Conship Holland leaves the port of Le Havre, France, for New York City. Her voyage is a classic rumline course from the English Channel straight through the fishing grounds. Scattered south of the Flemish Cap are the Hannibodon, the Allison, the Miss Millie, and the Seneca. The Mary T. and the Mr. Simon are southwest of the tail, right on the edge of the Gulf Stream, and Billy Tyne is nearly 600 miles to the east. Billy's been out through the dark of the moon, which may explain his bad luck, but things start to change around the 18th. The whole fleet, in fact, starts to get into a little more fish with the approach of the full moon. Tyne doesn't tell anyone how much he's catching, but he's rapidly making up for 3 weeks of thin fishing. He's probably pulling in swordfish at the same rate Johnston's pulling in big eye, 5,000 or 6,000 pounds a day. By the end of the month, he has 40,000 pounds of fish in his hold, worth around $160,000. I talked with Billy on the 24th, and he said he'd hatched his boat, Johnston says. He was headed in while the rest of us were just starting our trips. You could just tell he was happy. Billy finishes up his last haul around noon on the 25th, and the crew, still stowing their gear, turns his boat for home. They'll be one of the only boats in port with a load of fish, which means a short market and a high price. Captains dream of bringing 40,000 pounds into a short market. The weather's clear, the blue sky brushed with cirrus, and a solid northwest wind spackling the waves with white. A long, heavy swell rolls under the boat from a storm that passed far off to the south. Billy has a failing ice machine and a 1,200-mile drive ahead of him. He'll be heading in while the rest of the fleet is still in mid-trip, and he'll make port just as they're finishing up. He's 2 weeks out of sync. Ultimately, one could blame some invisible contortion of the Gulf Stream for this. The contortion disrupts the swordfish, which adds another week or two to the trip, which places the Andrea Gale on the Flemish Cap when she should already be heading in. The circumstances that place a boat at a certain place at a certain time are so random that they can't even be catalogued, much less predicted, and a total of 50 or 60 more people, swordfishermen, mariners, sailors, are also converging on the storm grounds of the North Atlantic. Some of these people have been heading there unavoidably for months. Others made a bad choice just a few days ago. In early September, a retired sailor named Ray Leonard started asking around Portland, Maine for a crew to help him sail his 32-foot Westsail sloop to Bermuda. Portland is a big sailing town. People race J-boats in the summer, crew on in the Caribbean in the winter, squeeze in a little skiing between seasons, and Leonard was quickly introduced to Karen Stimson, one of the most experienced sailors in the harbor. Stimson, 42, started crewing on boats as a teenager, graduated from Maritime Academy in her 30s, and has crossed the ocean several times on oil tankers. Between sailing trips, she and another woman, Sue Bylander, 38 years old, worked as graphic designers for a friend of Leonard's. Leonard offered them both a place on his boat if they would fly themselves home from Bermuda, and their boss said that they were free to take the time off if they wanted. They accepted, and a departure date was set for the last weekend in October. 1 month later, the sloop Satori cast off from the Great Bay Marina in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and motored slowly down the Piscataqua River toward open ocean. The weather was so warm that the crew were in T-shirts on deck, and the sky was the watery blue of Indian summer. A light wind came in from the west, a backing wind. The Satori ran down the Piscataqua under power, rendezvoused with another boat, cleared Kittery Point, and then bore away to the east. The two boats were headed for the Great South Channel between George's Bank and Cape Cod, and from there they would sail due south for Bermuda. Bylander stayed below to sort out the mountain of food and gear in the cabin, while Stimson and Leonard sat above deck and talked. Fog rolled in before they'd even cleared Isle of Shoals, and by dark the Satori was alone on a strangely quiet sea. When Bylander finished stowing the supplies, the crew squeezed around a small dinette table in the cabin and ate lasagna baked by Stimson's mother. Stimson has straw-blonde hair and a sort of level, gray-eyed look that seems to assess a situation, run the odds, and make a decision all in the same moment. She's no romantic. If you're looking for enlightenment, it's not going to happen on an oil tanker. But she's deeply in love with the ocean. She's not married and has no children. She's the perfect crew for a late-season run south. "So, Ray, have you listened to a weather forecast lately?" she asked at one point during dinner. Leonard nodded his head. "Did you hear there's a front coming through?" "It shouldn't be a problem," he says. "We can always cut into Buzzard's Bay." Buzzard's Bay is at the western end of the Cape Cod Canal. One could, if the weather were bad enough, go nearly all the way from Boston to New York City by protected waterways. It's not particularly beautiful, but it's safe. Ray was used to sailing solo, so having me on board may have made him feel more invulnerable, Stimson says. And there's a point at which you're so far out that you don't want to turn back. You just run offshore. In the future, I will listen to the weather forecast. I will decide, as crew, whether I'm willing to keep sailing. It will be immaterial to me the level of experience of the owner-captain. The date was October 26th. The lives of Stimson, Bylander, and Leonard were about to converge with several dozen others off the New England coast. Billy, like Leonard, has undoubtedly heard the forecast, but he's even less inclined to do anything about it than Leonard is. The lead time for an accurate forecast is only 2 or 3 days, and it takes twice that long for a sword boat to make port. Weather reports are vitally important to the fishing, but not so much for heading home. When the end of the trip comes, captains generally just haul their gear and go. Because errors compound, the longer the trip, the more careful the captain has to be when he sets his initial heading for home. An error of just 1 degree puts a boat 30 miles off course by the time she gets back to Gloucester. A captain could add a day to each trip with a month of such errors. When Billy Tyne starts for home, a bearing of 260 degrees would run him straight into Cape Ann, but it would also shave too close to Sable Island, which presents a ghastly hazard to shipping. "I try to avoid it by at least 40 or 50 miles," says Charlie Reed. The channel between Sable and Nova Scotia is blessed with a good, cold countercurrent that starts in Labrador and hugs the coast all the way down to Hatteras. But for some reason, Billy decides not to take it. He decides to cross the tail around 44 degrees north, his waypoint, and then, once clear of Sable, shoot a course almost due west for Gloucester. Fishing boats use a global positioning system for blue water navigation. GPS, as it's called, fixes a position relative to military satellites circling the Earth and then converts it to longitude and latitude. It's accurate to within 15 feet. The Department of Defense intentionally distorts the signals because they're worried about the misuse of such precise information, but the standards of accuracy on a sword boat are loose enough so that it doesn't matter. Fishermen generally use GPS to back up a Loran system, which works by measuring the time it takes for two separate low-frequency radio signals to reach the vessel from broadcasting stations on shore. Charts are printed with numbered lines radiating out from the signal sources, and a Loran reading identifies which lines correspond to the vessel's position. Even with two electronic systems, though, mistakes happen. Iron-bearing landmass, electrical interference, all kinds of things skew the output. Furthermore, the plotter gives you a pure direction, as if you could slice right through the curvature of the Earth, but boats must follow an arc from point to point, the Great Circle Route. The Great Circle Route requires a correction of about 11 degrees north between Gloucester and the Flemish Cap. On the night of October 24th, Billy Tyne punches in the Loran coordinates for his waypoint on the tail of the Banks and reads a bearing of 250 degrees on his video plotter. On a Great Circle Route, the compass heading and the actual heading are identical at the start of a trip, gradually diverge until the halfway point, and then converge again as the boat nears its destination. Having determined his Great Circle Route and plugged the heading into the autopilot, Tyne then goes over to the chart drawer and pulls out a $10 nautical chart called INT-109. He lines up a course of 250 degrees to his waypoint on the tail, and then walks his way down the map with a set of hinged parallel rules. He rechecks the bearing at the compass rose at the bottom and then adjusts by 20 degrees for the local magnetic variation. The Earth's magnetic field doesn't line up exactly with the axis of the Earth. In fact, it doesn't even come close. That should bring him to his waypoint on the tail in about 3 days. From there, he'll come up 14 degrees and take another Great Circle Route into Gloucester. INT-109 is one of the few charts that shows the full width and breadth of the summer sword fishing grounds and is carried by every sword boat in the Banks. It has a scale of 1 to 3.5 million. On a diagonal, it stretches from New Jersey almost to Greenland. Land on 109 is depicted the way mariners must see it, a blank, featureless expanse with a scattering of towns along a minutely rendered coast. The lighthouses are marked by fat exclamation points and jut from every godforsaken headland between New York City and South Wolf Island, Labrador. Water depth is given in meters, and shallow areas are shaded in blue. George's Bank is clearly visible off Cape Cod, an irregular shape about the size of Long Island and rising to a depth of 9 feet. To the west of George's is the Great South Channel. Beyond are the Nantucket Shoals and an area peppered with old ordnance. Submerged torpedo, unexploded depth charges, unexploded bombs. The 200-fathom line is the chart's most prominent feature, echoing the coastline in broad strokes like a low-angle shadow. It swings north around Georges, skirts Nova Scotia 100 miles offshore, and then runs deep up the St. Lawrence Seaway. East of the Seaway are the old fishing grounds of Burgio and St. Pierre Banks, and then the line makes an enormous seaward loop to the southeast, the Grand Banks. The banks are a broad, flat plateau that extend hundreds of miles southeast from Newfoundland before plunging off the continental shelf. A clump of terrors known as the Virgin Rocks lurks 70 miles east of St. John's, but otherwise there are no true shoals to speak of. A sheet of cold water called the Labrador Current flows over the northern edge of the banks, injecting the local food chain with plankton. And a sluggish, warm water flow called the North Atlantic Current creeps toward Europe east of the Flemish Cap. Bending around the tail of the banks is something called slope water, a cold, half-knot current that feeds into the generally eastward movement of the area. Below slope water is the Gulf Stream, trundling across the Atlantic at speeds of up to 3 or 4 knots. Eddies sometimes detach themselves from the Gulf Stream and spin off into the North Atlantic, dragging entire ecosystems with them. These eddies are called warm core rings. When the cores fall apart, the ecosystems die. Billy wants to run a slot between the Gulf Stream to the south and Sable Island to the north. It's a relatively straight shot that doesn't buck the warm head current or come too close in to Sable. Steaming around the clock, he's looking at a one-week trip. Maybe he even takes one bird out of the water to speed things up. The diesel engine has been throbbing relentlessly for a month now, and without the distraction of work, it suddenly seems hellishly loud. There's no way to escape the noise. It gets inside your skull, shakes your stomach lining, makes your ears ring. If the crew weren't so sleep-deprived, it might even bother them. As it is, they just wallow in their bunks and stand watch at the helm twice a day. After 2.5 days, the Andrea Gale has covered about 450 miles, right to the edge of the continental shelf. The weather's fair, and there's a good rolling swell from the northeast. At 3:15 on the afternoon of October 27th, Billy Tyne raises the Canadian Coast Guard on his single sideband to tell them he's entering Canadian waters. This is the American fishing vessel Andrea Gale, WYC-6681, he says. We're at 4425 north, 4905 west, bound for New England. All our fishing gear is stowed. The Canadian Coast Guard at St. John's gives him the go-ahead to proceed. Most of the Sword Fleet is a couple of hundred miles to the east, and Albert Johnston is the same distance to the south. Sable Island is no longer in the way, so Billy comes up 14 degrees and puts Gloucester right in his gun sights. They're heading almost due west and running a great circle route on autopilot. Around nightfall, a Canadian weather map creaks out of the satellite fax. There's a hurricane off Bermuda, a cold front coming down off the Canadian Shield, and a storm brewing over the Great Lakes. They're all heading for the Grand Banks. A few minutes after the fax, Linda Greenlaw calls. Billy, you seen the chart? She asks. Yeah, I saw it, he says. What do you think? Looks like it's going to be wicked. They agree to talk the next day so Billy can give her a list of supplies he's going to need. He has no desire at all to talk to Bob Brown. They sign off, and then Billy hands the helm off to Murph and goes below for dinner. They're in a big steel boat with 40,000 pounds of fish in the hold, plus ice. It takes a lot to sink a boat like that. Around 9 o'clock, a half moon emerges off their port quarter. The air's calm. The sky is full of stars. 2,000 miles away, weather systems are starting to collide. The barrel of the gun. The men could only look at each other through the falling snow, from land to sea, from sea to land, and realize how unimportant they all were. Ship on the Rocks, Newburyport, Massachusetts, 1839. No survivors. Sidney Perley, Historic Storms of New England, 1891. There's a certain amount of denial in sword fishing. The boats claw through a lot of bad weather, and the crews generally just batten down the hatches, turn on the VCR, and put their faith in the tensile strength of steel. Still, every man on a sword boat knows there are waves out there that can crack them open like a coconut. Oceanographers have calculated that the maximum theoretical height for wind-driven waves is 198 feet. A wave that size could put down a lot of oil tankers, not to mention a 72-foot sword boat. Once you're in the denial business, though, it's hard to know when to stop. Captains routinely overload their boats, ignore storm warnings, stow their life rafts in the wheelhouse, and disarm their emergency radio beacons. Coast Guard inspectors say that going down at sea is so unthinkable to many owner captains that they don't even take basic precautions. "We don't need an EPIRB because we don't plan on sinking," is a sentence that Coast Guard inspectors hear a lot. One of the videos on file with the Portland Coast Guard, shown as often as possible to local fishermen, was shot from the wheelhouse of a commercial boat during a really bad blow. It shows the bow rising and falling over mammoth, white-streaked seas. At one point, the captain says, a little smugly, "Yep, this is where you want to be, right in your wheelhouse, your own little domain." At that moment, a wall of water the size of a house fills the screen. It's no bigger than the rest of the waves, but it's solid and foaming and absolutely vertical. It engulfs the bow, the foredeck, the wheelhouse, and then blows all the windows out. The last thing the camera sees is white water coming at it like a big wet fist. The farther you work from shore, the less smug you can afford to be. Any weekend boater knows the Coast Guard will pluck him out of whatever idiocy he gets himself into. But sword boats don't have that option. They're working 400 or 500 miles from shore, way beyond helicopter range. So Billy, any blue water fisherman, has a tremendous respect for the big wet fist. When Billy receives the weather chart off the fax machine, he undoubtedly tells the crew that there's something very heavy on the way. There are specific things you can do to survive a storm at sea, and whether the crew does them and how well they do them depends on how jaded they all are. Billy has fished his whole life. Maybe he thinks nothing can sink him, or maybe the sea is every nightmare he's ever had. A good, worried crew starts by dogging down every hatch, porthole, and watertight door on the boat. That keeps breaking waves from busting things open and flooding the hold. They check the hatches on the lazarette, where the steering mechanism is housed, and make sure they're secure. A lot of boats founder when the lazarette floods. They check the bilge pump filters and fish out any debris floating in the bilge water. They clear everything off the deck, fishing gear, gaff pikes, oil slickers, boots, and put them down the fish hole. They remove the scupper plates so the boat can clear her decks. They tighten the anchor fastenings. They double-lash the fuel and water barrels on the whaleback. They shut off the gas cocks on the propane stove. They lash down anything in the engine room that might break loose and cause damage. They press down the fuel tanks so that some are empty and others are as full as possible. That reduces something called free surface effect, liquid sloshing around in tanks, changing the center of gravity. Some boats pay one crew member a bit extra to oversee the engine, but the Andrea Gale doesn't have such a position. Billy takes care of it himself. He climbs down the engine room companionway and runs through the checklist. Engine oil, hydraulics, batteries, fuel lines, air intakes, injectors. He makes sure the fire and high water alarms are on and the bilge pumps are working. He tests the backup generator. He hands out seasick pills. If one of the steel birds is out of the water, he puts it back in. He fixes his position on the chart and calculates how the weather will affect his drift. He reckons their course in his head in case a wave takes out their electronics. He checks the emergency lighting. He checks the survival suits. He checks the photos of his daughters. And then he settles down to wait. So far, the weather has been overcast, but calm, light winds out of the northwest and a little bit of sea. Before the Portland gale of 1898, one captain reported that it was the greasiest evening you ever saw. And a few hours later, 450 people were dead. It's not quite that calm, but almost. The wind hovers around 10 knots, and a 6-foot swell rolls lazily under the boat. The Andrea Gale passes just north of Albert Johnston during the night, and by dawn, they've almost made the western edge of the Banks, around 52 degrees west. They're halfway home. Dawn creeps in with a few shreds of salmon pink sky, and the wind starts to inch into the southeast. That's called a backing wind. It goes counterclockwise around the compass and usually means bad weather is coming. A backing wind is an ill wind. It's the first distant touch of a low-pressure system going into its cyclonic spin. Then another weather fax comes in. Hurricane Grace, moving, will turn northeast and accelerate. Developing dangerous storm, moving east 35 knots, will turn southeast and slow by 12 hours. Forecast winds 50 to 65 knots, and seas 22 to 32 feet within 400 nautical mile semicircle. It reads like an inventory of things fishermen don't want to hear. An accompanying chart shows Hurricane Grace as a huge swirl around Bermuda, and the developing storm has a tightly jammed set of barometric lines just north of Sable Island. Every boat in the Swordfish fleet receives this information. Albert Johnston, south of the tail, decides to head northwest into the cold water of the Labrador Current. Cold water is heavier, he says, and seems to lay better in the wind. It doesn't produce such volatile seas. The rest of the Sword fleet stays far to the east, waiting to see what the storm does. They couldn't make it into port in time anyway. The conch ship Holland, 100 miles south of Billy, heads straight into the teeth of the thing. 200 miles east, another container ship, the Liberian-registered Zara, also heads for New York. Ray Leonard, on the sloop Satori, has decided not to head for port. He holds to a southerly course for Bermuda. The Lorry Dawn 8 keeps plowing out to the fishing grounds, and the Asian Maru, 78, 150 miles due south of Sable Island, makes for Halifax Harbor to the northeast. Billy can either waste several days trying to get out of the way, or he can stay on course for home. The fact that he has a hold full of fish and not enough ice must figure into his decision. He did what 90% of us would have done. He battened down the hatches and hung on, says Tommy Barry, captain of the Allison. He'd been gone well over a month. He probably just said, "Screw it, we've had enough of this shit," and kept heading home. The Boston office of the National Weather Service occupies the ground floor of a low brick building along a gritty access road in back of Logan Airport. Heavy glass windows allow a tinted view of the U.S. Air Shuttle Terminal and a wasteland of gravel piles and rebar. Weather Service meteorologists can look up from their radar screens and watch U.S. air jets taxi back and forth behind a gray jet blast barrier. Only their stabilizers stick up above it. They cruise like silver sharks across a concrete sea. Weather generally moves west to east across the country with the jet stream. In a very crude sense, forecasting simply means calling up someone to the west of you and asking them to look out their window. In the early days, just after the Civil War, the National Weather Service was under the auspices of the War Department because that was the only agency that had the discipline and technology to relay information eastward faster than the weather moved. After the novelty of telegraph wore off, the Weather Service was shifted over to the Department of Agriculture, and it ultimately wound up in the Department of Commerce, which oversees aviation and interstate trucking. Regional Weather Service offices tend to be in very grim places, like industrial parks bordering metropolitan airfields. They have sealed windows and central air conditioning. Very little of the air being studied actually gets inside. October 28th is a sharp, sunny day in Boston. Temperatures in the 50s, with a stiff wind blowing off the ocean. A senior meteorologist named Bob Case is crisscrossing the carpeted room, consulting with the various meteorologists on duty that day. Most of them are seated at heavy blue consoles, staring resolutely at columns of numbers, barometric pressure, dew point, visibility, scrolling down computer screens. Behind the aviation desk is a bank of hotline phones, state emergency management, regional circuit, and hurricane. Twice a day, the state emergency management phone rings and someone in the office sprints to pick it up. It's the state testing its ability to warn people of a nuclear strike. Case is a fit, balding man in his mid-50s. A satellite photo of a hurricane about to clobber the coast of Maryland hangs in his office. He's responsible for issuing regional forecasts based on satellite imagery and a nationwide system called the Limited Fine Mesh, a grid superimposed on a map of the country where the corners represent data collection points. Twice a day, hundreds of LFM weather balloons are released to measure temperature, dew point, barometric pressure, and wind speed and relay the information back by theodolite. The balloons rise to 60,000 feet and then burst, allowing the instruments to float back to Earth on parachutes. When people find them, they mail them back to the Weather Service. The data from the LFM, plus input from 1,000 or so other ground sites around the country, is fed into huge Cray computers at the National Meteorological Center in Camp Springs, Maryland. The computers run numerical models of the atmosphere, and then spit forecasts back out to regional offices where they're amended by local meteorologists. Humans still add value to a forecast, as meteorologists say. There's an intuitive element to forecasting that even the most powerful computers cannot duplicate. Since early the previous day, Case has been watching something called a shortwave trough aloft slide eastward from the Great Lakes. On satellite photos, it looks like an S-curve in the line of clear, dry air moving south from Canada. Cold air is denser than warm air, and huge, slow undulations develop along the boundary between them and roll eastward, on their side, as it were, much like an ocean swell. The undulation gets more and more pronounced until the crest gets separated from the rest of the warm front and just starts to spin around itself. This is called a cutoff low or an occluded front. Air gets sucked in toward the center. The system spins faster and faster, and within hours, you have a storm. The mechanics of a hurricane are fundamentally the same as a cutoff low, but their origins differ. Hurricanes brew in the lukewarm waters around the equator. When the sun hits the equator, it hits it dead on. A square foot beam of light heating up exactly 1 square foot of water. The farther north or south you are, the lower the angle of the sun, and the more water a square foot of sunlight must heat up. As a result, the water doesn't heat up as much. The equatorial sea cooks all summer and evaporates huge amounts of water into the air. Evaporated water is unstable and contains energy in the same way that a boulder on top of a hill does. One small push unleashes a huge destructive force. Likewise, a drop in air temperature causes water vapor to precipitate out as rain and release its latent energy back into the atmosphere. The air above 1 square foot of equatorial water contains enough latent energy to drive a car 2 miles. A single thunderstorm could supply 4 days' worth of the electrical power needed by the United States. Warm air is less dense than cool air. It rises off the surface of the ocean, cools in the upper atmosphere, and then dumps its moisture before rushing back to Earth. Huge cumulus clouds develop over the zones of rising air, with thunder, lightning, and terrifically strong rain. As long as there's a supply of warm water, the thunderstorm sustains itself, converting moisture into sheeting rain and downdraft winds. Other thunderclouds might line up along the leading edge of a cold front into a squall line, a towering convective engine that stretches from horizon to horizon. Hurricanes start when a slight kink, a disturbance in the trade winds, a dust storm blowing out to sea off the Sahara, develops in the upper level air. The squall line starts to rotate around the kink, drawing in warm, volatile air and sending it up the gathering vortex at its center. The more air that gets drawn in, the faster it spins, and the more water is evaporated off the ocean. The water vapor rises up the core of the system and releases rain and latent heat. Eventually, the system starts spinning so fast that inward spiraling air can no longer overcome the centrifugal force and make it into the center. The eye of the storm has formed, a column of dry air surrounded by a solid wall of wind. Tropical birds get trapped inside and cannot escape. A week later, after the system has fallen apart, frigate birds and egrets might find themselves over Newfoundland, say, or New Jersey. A mature hurricane is by far the most powerful event on Earth. The combined nuclear arsenals of the United States and the former Soviet Union don't contain enough energy to keep a hurricane going for one day. A typical hurricane encompasses 1 million cubic miles of atmosphere and could provide all the electric power needed by the United States for 3 or 4 years. During the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, winds surpassed 200 miles an hour and people caught outside were sandblasted to death. Rescue workers found nothing but their shoes and belt buckles. So much rain can fall during a hurricane, up to 5 inches an hour, that the soil liquefies. Hillsides slump into valleys and birds drown in flight, unable to shield their upward-facing nostrils. In 1970, a hurricane drowned 500,000 people in what is now Bangladesh. In 1938, a hurricane put downtown Providence, Rhode Island, under 10 feet of ocean. The waves generated by that storm were so huge that they literally shook the earth. Seismographs in Alaska picked up their impact 5,000 miles away. A lesser version of that is heading toward the Grand Banks. Hurricane Grace, a late-season fluke that still contains enough energy to crank another storm system off the chart. Ordinarily, Grace would come ashore somewhere in the Carolinas, but the same cold front that spawned the shortwave trough aloft also blocks her path onshore. Cold air is very dense, and warm weather systems tend to bounce off them like beach balls off a brick wall. According to atmospheric models generated by the Cray computers in Maryland, Grace will collide with the cold front and be forced northward, straight into the path of the shortwave trough. Wind is simply air rushing from an area of high pressure to an area of low. The greater the pressure difference, the faster it blows. An Arctic cold front bordering a hurricane-fortified low will create a pressure gradient that meteorologists may not see in their lifetime. Ultimately, the engine behind all of this activity is the jet stream, a river of cold upper-level air that screams around the globe at 30 or 40,000 feet. Storms, cold fronts, shortwave troughs. They're all dragged eastward sooner or later by upper-level winds. The jet stream is not steady. It convulses like a loose fire hose, careening off mountains, veering across plains. These irregularities create continent-sized eddies that come ballooning out of the Arctic as deep cold fronts. They're called anti-cyclones because the cold air in them flows outwards and clockwise, the opposite of a low. It's along the leading edge of these anti-cyclones that low-pressure waves sometimes develop. Occasionally, one of these waves will intensify into a major storm. Why and when is still beyond the powers of science to predict. It typically happens over areas where a leg of the jet stream collides with subtropical air. The Great Lakes, the Gulf Stream off Hatteras, the Southern Appalachians. Since air flows counterclockwise around these storms, the winds come out of the northeast as they move offshore. For that reason, they're known as nor'easters. Meteorologists have another name for them. They call them bombs. The first sign of the storm comes late on October 26th, when satellite images reveal a slight bend in the leading edge of the cold front over western Indiana. The bend is a pocket of low barometric pressure, a shortwave trough, embedded in the wall of the cold front at around 20,000 feet. It's the embryo of a storm. The trough moves east at 40 miles an hour, strengthening as it goes. It follows the Canadian border to Montreal, cuts east across northern Maine, crosses the Bay of Fundy, and traverses Nova Scotia throughout the early hours of October 28th. By dawn, an all-out gale is raging north of Sable Island. The upper-level trough has disintegrated, to be replaced by a sea-level low, and warm air is rising out the top of the system faster than it can be sucked in at the bottom. That's the definition of a strengthening storm. The barometric pressure is dropping more than a millibar an hour, and the Sable Island storm is sliding away fast to the southeast with 65-knot winds and 30-foot seas. It's a tightly packed low that Billy Tyne, 200 miles away, can't even feel yet. The Canadian government maintains a data buoy 70 miles east of Sable Island at 43.8 north and 57.4 west, just short of Billy's position. It's simply known as buoy number 44139. There are eight others like it between Boston and the Grand Banks. They relay oceanographic information back to shore on an hourly basis. Throughout the day of October 28th, buoy number 44139 records almost no activity whatsoever. Dinghy sailing weather on the high seas. At 2 o'clock, the needle jumps, though. Suddenly, the seas are 12 feet and the winds are gusting to 15 knots. That in itself is nothing, but Billy must know he has just seen the first stirrings of the storm. The wind calms down again, and the seas gradually subside. But a few hours later, another weather report creaks out of the radio fax. Warnings. Hurricane Grace moving east 5 knots. Maximum winds 65 knots, gusting to 80 near center. Forecast dangerous storm winds 50 to 75 knots and seas 25 to 35 feet. Billy's at 44 north, 56 west, and heading straight into the mouth of meteorological hell. For the next hour, the sea is calm, horribly so. The only sign of what's coming is the wind direction. It shifts restlessly from quadrant to quadrant all afternoon. At 4 o'clock, it's out of the southeast. An hour later, it's out of the south-southwest. An hour after that, it's backed around to due north. It stays that way for the next hour, and then right around 7 o'clock, it starts creeping into the northeast. And then it hits. It's a sheer change. The Andrea Gale enters the Sable Island storm the way one might step into a room. The wind is instantly 40 knots and parting through the rigging with an unnerving scream. Fishermen say they can gauge how fast the wind is, and how worried they should be, by the sound it makes against the wire stays and outrigger cables. A scream means the wind is around force 9 on the Beaufort scale, 40 or 50 knots. Force 10 is a shriek. Force 11 is a moan. Over force 11 is something fishermen don't want to hear. Linda Greenlaw, captain of the Hannah Bowden, was in a storm where the wind registered 100 miles an hour before it tore the anemometer off the boat. The wind, she says, made a sound she'd never heard before, a deep tonal vibration like a church organ. There was no melody, though. It was a church organ played by a child. By 8 o'clock, the barometric pressure has dropped to 996 millibars and shows no sign of leveling off. That means the storm is continuing to strengthen and create an even greater vacuum at its center. Nature, as everyone knows, abhors a vacuum and will try to fill it as fast as possible. The waves catch up with the wind speed around 8 p.m., and begin increasing exponentially. They double in size every hour. After 9 o'clock, every graph line from data buoy 44139 starts climbing almost vertically. Maximum wave heights peak at 45 feet, drop briefly, and then nearly double to 70. The wind climbs to 50 knots by 9 p.m. and gradually keeps increasing until it peaks at 58 knots. The waves are so large that they block the anemometer, and gusts are probably reaching 90 knots. That's 104 miles an hour. Gale force 12 on the Beaufort scale. The cables are moaning. Minutes after the evening weather report, Tommy Barry raises tine on the single sideband. Barry's from Florida, a solid, square-shouldered guy with slick-backed hair and a voice like a box of rocks. He wants to know, of all things, how much gear to fish that night. He's 600 miles to the east and figures he might as well squeeze in as much fishing as he can. The conversation, as Barry remembers it, is brief and to the point. "We're over here around the 46, Billy. What's it look like?" "It's blowing 50 to 80 and the seas are 30 feet. It was calm for a while, but now it's starting to come on pretty good. I'm 130 miles east of Sable." "Okay, we're going to keep the gear in the boat, but let's talk at 11. Maybe we'll throw a little bit of gear in late." "All right, I'll give you a check after the weather. I'll tell you what's going on out here. We'll be standing by." After talking to Barry, Billy picks up the microphone on his single sideband and issues one last message to the fleet. "She's coming on, boys, and